Okay. Thank you for coming. My name is John Ennis. I'm with the Office for Disarmament Affairs. I'd like to introduce the people who are at the desk. The High Representative for Disarmament Affairs, Ms. Angela Kane. The head of the mission, the UN mission, is Dr. Åke Sällström. With him is Mr. Scott Cairns of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, one of the team leaders, and also Dr. Maurizio Barbeschi, another team leader from the World Health Organization. So Professor Sällström is going to make a statement, and then we will take questions. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry.
Clearly, we don't have this rehearsed properly.
High Representative Kane is going to make a statement. Then Dr. Sällström, and then we will take questions.
Okay. I don't want to make an introductory statement. I just wanted to thank you for being here. I know there has already quite a bit of publication flurry, if I can call it that, after the report was put on the web yesterday. I'm simply here to answer any questions when it comes to the Secretary General's mechanism or anything that relates to the UN Secretariat, and also for the overall effort that the Secretary General entrusted me with. But the real people who have to tell the story are really Professor Sällström, Scott Cairns, and Maurizio Barbeschi, and they are the ones who are going to speak, and they are the ones who are going to hopefully also able to answer all of your questions. I'm sure that you have many of them. So let me turn to Åke.
As you're well aware of, we yesterday delivered our final report to the Secretary General of the investigation of allegations on chemical weapons use in Syria. In total, the Secretary General had received 16 allegations. We reviewed those allegations, and seven of them warranted further investigations. So the report, what you have probably studied or maybe should study, is the seven follow-up on the seven allegations. In conclusion, they split into three groups. There is one group with the allegations which is relatively large size events. They encompass parts of the society, the military, the hospitals, rescue workers, several witnesses, and whatever. Those type of allegations is quite simple to investigate, especially if you are in the site, like you are in Huta. In Kanasal, the second place we investigated, we were not able to go there. But the footprints in the society following a large event is so obvious that you can make conclusions from what we refer to as epidemiology. The second class of events that we now report to are three events that happened to the in a medium-sized environment, and it happened to soldiers, to Syrian soldiers. We find, as we see these soldiers, we interview them and so on. In some places we were able to go, in other places we were not able to go to the site because it was contested. But the evidence in this group of events is based basically on interviews and blood samples taken. In the third class of investigations that we performed, we deal with something which is quite unique in the context of chemical weapons, and that is very small amounts being used. And this comes to the Sarakeb incident, and this also comes to the Sheikh Maksud incident. The Sheikh Maksud incident we couldn't pursue. The Sheikh Maksud incident we couldn't pursue. The Sarakeb incident we could pursue because a woman that was intoxicated in in Sarakeb was taken by ambulances into Turkey. She died passing the border into Turkey, and we could then take samples in an autopsy performance, and we could then confirm the presence of sarin or sarin signatures in pieces. So these are the three sorts of events that we now report on, and as you know, our mandate is only to report on the use of chemical weapons. I would like to acknowledge the contribution of my colleagues, WHO and OPCW, and I would also like to acknowledge all the UN support that has been from the ODA, from the Office of Legal Affairs, that sort of paid the political route for this mission to be possible, but also the support from several logistics efforts and security efforts with the three organizations, with WHO, with UN, and with OPCW. I will not say any more. I think the floor is really yours. The floor is to say questions. If my colleagues want to have a comment at this stage.
I'll just take questions.
Okay, so we'll take questions if you can announce what organization you're with, and if possible, if you can use your side microphone, please.
My name is Masood. I represent the New York United Nations Forest Fund Association, and I represent the Daily Dawn newspaper of Pakistan. My question to you is that, which is the follow-up on all the report and everything else, everybody else is asking the same question, that you have seen, you have been to those places, and you have determined that, in fact, chemical weapons were used by both sides. Now, the basic question comes in that, yes, you did not have the mandate to apportion the blame as to who is the one to be blamed. So, but in the broader sense, can you at any point in time at least suggest that this is what happened, and that the for the mitigation of the people who were hurt in that thing, that certain measures that can be taken to bring to justice the people who did commit these crimes? So did you come across any such things? And these are the questions which are now haunting our minds. Thank you.
Thank you for your question. First of all, you say that both sides were active, and we don't say that in our report. To go from the step where we are to confirm the use and to go into attribution requires quite some more efforts. It requires more resources. And on top of that, it requires that the mechanism that we are following, the guidelines that we are using, allow methods to be used that is not allowed today. The guidelines that we're working through is set by the member states, and they are not very intrusive. The techniques and the technologies you need to do a forensic investigation could be intrusive to the extent that it's not allowed in the guidelines. I think it was a wise decision that we shouldn't try to go into the attribution and try to pursue the investigation into the attribution. We are there to find facts. We are on a fact-finding mission, and these facts that we report upon could be used by others, possibly. Others could put these facts in some connection, could have other sort of information, and others could pursue the issue about perpetrator or attribution.
Question is only one, is that do you believe that you were given all the opportunities to perform the functions of your responsibility completely to your satisfaction, or do you think that you could have had some more time to come to more conclusions? And do you think that time was not given to you or was given to you?
Given the circumstances, I think we had the time and the resources that we needed.
Hi, Colm Lynch from the Washington Post and Foreign Policy Magazine. What we were told that when you provide the council with a briefing on Al Ghouta, that you had characterized the sort of quality of the sarin as fairly high grade or very high quality. And what you can confirm or you know, to say what you want about that. But what I'm trying to do is get a sense of some of the recent cases, particularly Joe Barr and some of the ones which involved poisoning of soldiers, whether you were able in any way to sort of compare the quality of the sarin. Was it of a similar grade? Was it of a lower grade? And also, was there anything about those more recent incidents in which I know you didn't have access to a lot of the munitions, that some of the evidence was degraded, but anything which indicated that it was of, you know, a less sophisticated type of delivery systems or anything that indicated that this was more of a do-it-yourself kind of, sort of weapon or, you know, sarin than...
Coming into if the chemistry is primitive or mature, so to say, is a difficult issue. And you need quite much chemical to be able to assess that. What we have done in the last investigations is to find remainders of sarin in blood, where you don't find very much sarin. It's very little you find, actually, of remaining of the sarin. So it's impossible to have that sort of discussion. When it comes to the munition, we cannot confirm, we cannot verify the allegations when it comes to munition, but the allegations talk about the catapult. The allegations talk about a sort of homemade device like a propane cylinder. But this goes with the allegations, and it's not verified by us.
I will, the last part,
I will send to my chemist colleague and about hexamine. The first one, yes, again, it's the allegation and some witnesses reporting that we could not corroborate the statements of the plastic cylinder. It's not corroborated by us. It's not verified by us. We never visited places, we never saw the munition in its primary state, so to say, in its native state. So again, strange munition is reported upon. We have not been able to verify it. And as come to the hexamine, please. What is the significance of that?
Well, the significance of hexamine, which is a commercial chemical and can be found in a multitude of places. Some allege that the hexamine is used as a acid scavenger or stabilizer for a completed sarin produced through the binary method. Others have alleged that it is a remnant or an artifact of production of RDX, which is a high explosive. It's also used as a heating element for little homemade stoves. It has a number of uses. We did find it, and I think you'll see in the final report a much more comprehensive detailing of some of the chemicals that were found, particularly in the Huta incidents. And in those samples, you will see that hexamine is found.
Was that the only incident in which hexamine was found?
Well, unfortunately, those were the only samples or the only environmental samples that we were able to take at the time. I think it's quite clear, again, from the report where we were able to get to and what type of samples we were able to take.
Sure. Thanks a lot. Matthew Lee, Inner City Press. On behalf of the Free UN Coalition for Access, thanks for doing the briefing. It's too rare in the UN system. So I wanted to ask you about the report on page 28 where you're talking about Khan al-Assal says that the mission received a video pertaining to the incident. So I wanted to know if there was a Russian journalist who said it was a 2-gigabyte file. Anastasia Popova was her name. If that was the case, and if you found the video of use. And as to Huta, I wanted to know just a couple of things. One is, some people say that Modamia, the rocket, was filmed elsewhere before you guys looked at it. And I wanted to know, is it only one rocket that was looked at, and are you aware of this countervailing claim? And also what you think the range of the rocket on Zamalka, what the range was. There seems to be a lot of it seems, as to where it came from, seems to ride on that. And I wonder what your finding is on that. Thank you.
Yes, the video you refer to is the correct video you describe yourself. That video, together with a lot of open source information, of course, help us to build a background narrative. As with the other open source information and that video, it's difficult to verify. We have to be on site. We have to be in the country to verify what sort of narrative is built from the videos and the open sources. Then you move to the Mahadamia incident, and you refer to the rocket being seen somewhere else. We have nothing that no evidence has been presented to us that make us confirm that. What else? You said, is that... Yeah, I mean, we have seen, probably like you have seen others, performing whatever studies on these rockets. And we have consulted with experts. And if you simulate the flight path, it seemed not to meet, as we may be indicated from the report, or you may draw the conclusion from the report. 2 kilometers could be a fair guess, I would assume. But it all depends. You have to sort of set some parameters which we do not know. We do not know to the extent they were filled or what they were filled with. We don't know their weight or whatever. But 2 kilometers could be a fair guess. What else? Questions were there?
No, that's pretty much it.
Fine.
So it's the gentleman in the second row here, and I got track of who's asked.
Thank you. Joe Lauria from the Wall Street Journal. On the Jobar attack, you mentioned in the report there was an IED that contained the gas, most likely. Is that something you've seen before? Is that something that that's even in the government arsenal? Have they used them? I haven't heard about IED. Of course, we all know about them from Iraq. But in Syria, I haven't heard much about it. Is that something the government would use? And to follow up on Colum's question, did you tell the Security Council about the quality of the gas? Because that was leaked. Was a gas leak, I guess, from the council about what you're talking about, the quality of sarin. Just if you can address that. Thank you.
Yes, I tried to make some comment on the quality of sarin, and I compared it to my experience in Iraq. The IED, I'm not weapons expert enough. May I call on you again? I think we have seen other IEDs in Syria, although not as many and not as well known as the IED mainly used in Iraq, as you refer to. But there are other evidence for it, isn't it? Correct.
Are you specifically talking about a chemical IED?
Well, IEDs in general, but this one had chemicals in it, apparently. Is this something that the government's been using or that appears to be what insurgents or guerrillas use more likely?
Well, I think in the history of warfare, improvised explosive devices have been used by all parties to all conflicts at certain periods within the conflicts, whether they're modern forces or guerrilla forces. So we can't speak to who may possess or who may use IEDs in the country. However, I think a lot of the social media and events that have coming out of Syria have shown that explosive devices, whether they're improvised or not, have been used.
But the government soldiers were the victims in that case. Doesn't that tell you something?
It's not for me to say who is a victim of an IED.
The report says it's the government. The government soldiers were victims.
Yes, I understand that the report says that the victims were government soldiers, but I have no way of knowing the nationality or the identity of the improvised explosive device.
This is the first time you have ever reported government soldiers being victims of gas. Is that correct?
May I just say, it's correct what you last said, but we also say in the report that because of the circumstances at the scene, we could not corroborate the link between the site and the soldiers.
On all three instances.
No, we talk specifically on the Jobar.
Yeah.
And the other two were soldiers who were involved? Could you corroborate?
No, it's the same. In Hamasal, it's a different story, yes. In Hamasal, we corroborate the allegations.
Okay. Woman in the first row.
Thank you very much. Edith Lederer from the Associated Press. Before I ask my question, I wonder if you could tell us what you told the members of the General Assembly about the quality of sarin, so we don't have to go and ask all our diplomatic friends and get it wrong. But my real question is that the Secretary General just urged that those responsible for these attacks be brought to justice. And I know you sort of addressed that in the beginning, but what I'm asking you is it actually, if more research were done, if other people took this up with a different mandate than you had, is it possible to determine who was responsible?
To take the last question first, and I will call on you really, because it's really, it has some political inclination, the question. We work with something we call the Secretary General's mechanism that is given to the Secretary General by the General Assembly. But it also states sort of the rules for what can be used when you do these investigations. And we could lean on what is told in the decision taken in 1989. But we could also lean on what is agreed upon, what the OPCW could do, what the WHO could do. But it's all sort of controlled by the member states of these various organizations. So we are not free as, you know, a police force would be free to use any method that they could validate or where they could have a chain of custody. Member states, if, like several member states now call upon going further on this, there are other ways to do that. And here maybe I should let you say something.
Thank you. Before I come back to that question, let me say that Professor Sellstrom and the team did not make a statement just now in the General Assembly. The Secretary General made a statement to introduce the report, and then it was a chance for member states to respond to it. So they did not make a statement. Coming back to the mechanism, you know that there have been a number of calls for additional mechanism, for additional investigations, and I think that what Professor Sellstrom and the team have said is this is the mandate that we have, this is the mandate we were given by the member states, and if there are other ways to come to a truth-finding, if I can call it that, as to the responsibility, surely that will be undertaken. I think we must also remember that we've had two more recent experiences, not chemical weapons, but two recent investigations that were conducted. One was in Lebanon about the Hariri investigation, assassination, and the other one was about Pakistan and Benazir Bhutto. So mechanisms were, let's say, decreed by the member states for those particular cases. But in this case, the Secretary General's mechanism explicitly says whether but not who used chemical weapons.
So the Commission of Human Rights.
The Commission of Human Rights, of course.
There is also, is mentioned on paragraph...
I'm sorry.
Yeah. On page 9, is mentioned that the Commission of Human Rights has a more precise mandate to identify who or would not. So that's the fora. There are two or three of those commissions you can seek.
Using your results.
No. They're different mandate. They are there to investigate who was any. Just chemical weapon is a subset.
But with the help of your results.
Yeah, they could.
We contribute. Yeah, they're part of the same thing. It's a good example of interagency collaboration.
A woman in the eighth row.
Eva Font for Radio France International. My question is, you can say who was responsible for the use of chemical weapons, though there is the evidence that they were used against soldiers. Then if there are another elements besides of the army using chemical weapons, how can you make sure that in Syria the chemical weapons are going to be eliminated in the country?
Oops.
Totally.
Oops. This is totally outside the task that we have been given. Would you like to comment on that?
Actually, I wonder whether it should be me or whether it should be now or OPCW, because Syria, as you know, acceded to the Chemical Weapons Convention. So this is a totally new mechanism now, and the OPCW has the mandate to verify that the stocks are just destroyed, and also to verify that the stocks are actually as declared by the government. So I think that this is in the process that's ongoing now. I think you know the deadline is by the 30th of June next year, and so far we are on track. But maybe Scott, who is from OPCW, should really address this.
Government does. Another thing is other elements, like maybe other factions that are using chemical weapons, then it's not under control. There is a war there.
That's a good point. However, the fathers of the OPCW, or the fathers and mothers of the Chemical Weapons Convention, haven't put in within the convention the requirement for the acceding member state to implement legislation within their country to make it illegal to possess, use, or otherwise control chemical weapons. So we expect, like all member states, that Syria will implement such legislation, making it illegal for anyone within their territory or citizens of Syria to possess, use, or otherwise control chemical warfare agents or chemical weapons.
May I remind you that there is a firewall between these two activities. We are confined to the investigating the use, and this totally another activity that is taking care of the chemical weapon and transporting them out of the country or whatever.
My twin brother. Yes.
Gentleman in the first row.
Thank you. My name is Talal Haj from Al Arabiya News Channel. You were very careful with preserving the chain of custody when you transfer the samples to the laboratories in Europe. And I understand, if correct me if I'm wrong, that you had two officials from the Syrian government to accompany the samples. But did you have officials or observers from the opposition? We have two parties to this conflict. Unless you represented the opposition, you should have also, because they also face accusations of using chemical weapon. And if you didn't, why didn't you have officials from the opposition to accompany the samples to the laboratories? Because really, it gave the impression, if you didn't, that the government is the one who's accused. The second question is, looking at the deadlock we have at the Security Council and the use of veto, if the information you supplied was never used somehow to pinpoint the culprit, responsible parties for this, would that really disappoint you a great deal, that so much work, so much effort, so much risks you've taken, and then they're not used to determine who's the guilty party and punish them and to stop further attacks in the future as a deterrent, like the SG said?
The last question first. I think we have gathered as much information as we could. What eventually will happen with this information, how it will be used in the future, we don't know. But it could be useful if the issue is to be pursued by some other body. When it comes to the presence of representatives of the Syrian government in the chain of custody issue, it's set out in the guidelines that if we take samples, we are to split the samples with the member state. And the member state, in this case, we do two ways. When we draw blood, take blood samples, we take blood samples, they take blood samples on the same patient at the same time, and we split it this way. When it comes to soil or comes to metal pieces, this is much, much more difficult to do. If we take a metal piece and we, you know, break it in the middle, we may have a positive side of that, and they may have a negative, or the other way around. So in order to split samples when it comes to what we refer to as environmental samples, soils, metal pieces, or whatever, that has to be done in the laboratory of OPCW. And the guidelines then say that the member state should be there. And there is only one representative of the member state.
There are two parties in the conflict, and so many fingers now pointing to the opposition for the use of chemical weapons, but they were not invited to preserve the chain of custody. That's my problem with this.
Right.
I'm sorry, let me just come in here. We are an organization that deals, as you well know, with member states. And in the mechanism, it is very clearly stated how we proceed in a case of a chemical weapons investigation or use, alleged use of chemical weapons. And the Syrian government, as you also remember, was the one who came to us. There are very distinct guidelines. I mean, this is a 90-page document. I'm sure you've looked at it. And in the 90-page document, every step is outlined. And then on top of that, you make an agreement with the government exactly how you proceed. and that is the way that we proceed. We split the samples with the government because they need to know that these samples actually were taken from their soil and from the people that, that they met and that they sampled and took the case histories of.
Woman in the fourth row. Evelyn Leopold. Mrs. Kane, can you use your considerable influence to get another agency to break the firewall? Because as you can see by the questions and as you have heard, it's a chasm where everyone rushes in depending on their political preference, and the issue will not be solved of whether the government or the opposition uses it unless there's some naming and shaming.
Thank you for the compliment of my considerable influence, but I'm afraid that when you look at it, I am really very pleased in many aspects that what we now have is, as I think, a belief as a result of this investigation that took place. We had Syria acceding to the Chemical Weapons Convention, and that is a fantastic achievement. That leaves only four countries that are outside the Chemical Weapons Convention. Two have signed and not ratified, so basically it's six, but basically it's a very, very small number. And the ambassador of one of those countries assured me last night that they are in the process and they're very close to acceding to the Chemical Weapons Convention as well. So that is really very, very good news. But I do think that this is now, if I can call it that, a chapter. The investigation is done, and that's a chapter that is closed. There may be something that will happen subsequently with regard to the accountability. That's really up to member states. But on the other hand, I think the firewall has to be there because you can't commingle this. This is a different activity that's taking place now between the OPCW UN mission. It's a very collaborative effort, but I think that the firewall is there for a good reason, and so I would not use my influence to break that.
Gentleman in the third row.
James Bayes from Al Jazeera. The world has your 82-page document now of what you came up with the result within this mandate. We talk about future investigations. Maybe your data and your samples one day will become evidence. Where are they? What happens to them? And how can they be obtained by a prosecuting authority? Could the International Criminal Court? Could a private prosecution? Who can get hold of your raw data, raw samples now?
They are stored. That's part of the guidelines. Everything is stored and everything is accessible if that is a legal procedure. I don't know. We've actually
discussed this, and it is a very good question. Basically, the work was done by the Secretary's mechanism, so the samples and everything else is the property of the UN. There is considerable interest not only in the possibility of following up with regards to accountability question, but there's also considerable interest on the part of the laboratories that have performed the analyses, because again, it was like, after a very long time, after many years, for many, the first time that they ever had such complete samples. So there's considerable interest in publishing also some of the results and also some of having the research that was done on that. We have not come to a final conclusion. Frankly, for us, the first priority is to get the investigation done, to put it before the world community and say, here it is. And now the next step that we need to concentrate on is exactly how is it going to be safeguarded, how is it going to be stored, how is it going to be guarded as a living document, if you so want, that can be accessed by others, if so wanted.
But if a victim of this decided to take out a private prosecution, would the UN hand over the samples? What are the rules governing this?
I would have to request advice from our legal counsel, frankly. I'm not a lawyer.
I think it's also important to remind you that the samples and the information that we received is still held under a chain of custody. Mm-hmm. So the chain of custody did not end when the samples were opened for analysis. They were the remnants of the material was put back into vials, sealed up, and the chain of custody remains.
This is a very good point, if I may add. In your question, there is a huge scientific value in having seen document the victims in the first place, the clinical features, the symptoms, the treatment that had been received. There is a lot to be learned and to validate what we think we know. about the handling and the managing of chemical casualties, chemical weapon casualties. So it's important that bodies like you serves not just the sample in itself, the silver bullet, but also the studies and the knowledge that can use in a positive spin to save more lives next time that happens.
Let me add a kind of a human element to this, and this is that there were many victims, there were many case studies, they were videoed, they were recorded, etc. So there's an element of privacy here also. These people trusted us with that information, so we have to be very careful that we don't use it in a way that would be contrary to their interests.
And you will find the first time in reports like that that you have ethic considerations. Chapter.
The woman in the first row.
Thank you. My name is Sylviane Zahil, Lorient Le Jour, Beirut. On the destruction of the chemical weapons, is there any safe mechanism to get rid of these chemical weapons? And which country will supervise the destruction of these chemical weapons? And where will it be dumped? Because there are reports that it might be dumped in Lebanon.
I don't think we have the answer to your questions. I mean, chemical weapons are destroyed at this time. It's done in this country. It's done in Russian Federation. There are safe ways of doing it. Activity has been going on for 15 years or 16 years. So they are safe way of doing it. And there are risk assessments being done. All precautions are being taken. So whatever the end result of this, we should trust, I think. And I trust it will not stay in Lebanon. It isn't in
Lebanon. Gentleman in the second row.
Yes, Dr. Hedstrom, Stefano Vaccara, Radio Radicale in Rome, and La Voce di New York. When you just arrived, you said, if I understood well, you said that you were able to do successful this mission because you had the mission not to find out who actually used it. I'm just paraphrasing, but that's what I understood. I mean, what you mean is that if instead your mission would have been different, you will not be able, I mean, the way maybe the Syrian government or any other will have been acted, you feel that you will not be able to accomplish what you did, and then before you arrived to Syria, you must have an idea what you are going to do, I mean, what you're going to accomplish. And today, 1 to 10, how much are you satisfied with your work?
Oh, I think your first question has a political dimension and a technical dimension. I mean, if we were to do the attribution, this would be a different political issue, and it would be a different political setting. I will not comment on that. Maybe you could. But technically, I think we did what we could do. We used the instruments that were there for us to use, and we arrived at the conclusion. On a scale of from 0 to 10, I think we are in 8.7 something. I think the It's very difficult to go from where we are using the same information. I would not be able to pinpoint who is the perpetrator. I would not be able to say that. You have to have more intrusive methods. You have to use methods that is not validated yet and so on. So given the task, that given the mandate that we have lived up to the scale of 8.7, I would say.
May I comment? There is a difficult art in getting. There is a difficult art in planning for a mission and going right after an incident where you can undergo in certain activities. And while the political dimension and the negotiations are taking place, the entry point slips in time. So the planning and the type of technique that you would use will change and adapt accordingly. So the Ghouta investigation, the scale, the tragedy was horrendous, but was a few days after the incident. And the evidence and the patient and the suffering was so evident that is one type of investigation. Going to the same, another investigation 6 months later, you have to go by a set of successful and succeeding chain of thinking and proving one after the other. And that was due to the political negotiation and the harmony between the two. So it wasn't just one technical dimension and only a political one, but the interlock of the two of them.
One or two more questions? So Mr. Lynch, and then does anyone else have a question?
Thank you.
If you're in front, and that'd be it.
After you finish the Yalgoota investigation report, Syria has provided under the separate mandate for the elimination of its CW, it presented a declaration of what it has. And what I wanted to know is whether you guys have looked at that, whether it shed any light on, deepened your understanding of what may have happened in Ghouta. Are there, for instance, evidence of munitions that were in use in Yalgoota are linked to the case? Are they the kinds of things that Syria had in their stockpile? Is there anything that, you know, that provided sort of a greater understanding of what might have happened? I mean, I understand your mandate is not to find out who, but this is kind of factual information that I think, you know, one might want to look at.
I could say no comment, but I will give you an answer, and that is not really. Not really. There's no information around that shed light on what's happening in Ghouta.
Well, can I ask a question to prevent that? I mean, is there things like munitions that were found at Ghouta, did they not appear in the declaration?
No, I have to say I cannot answer that question.
Can I just follow
up? We said this was going to be the last question with this.
Just follow up.
Okay, I guess one and a half.
Are you telling us really that you have? Sorry.
Are you asking us to believe that you have no inkling after all this research and all this hard work and risk to your life and your colleagues? You have no inkling who is the guilty party in any of the attacks? Because if you are telling us that, what good are your, with all due respect, your results to the future investigations or any attempt to persecute the culprits?
I am quite happy with what we have achieved. We have probably triggered the Syrian government to give up their chemical weapons. I'm quite happy with that. I'm quite happy with the scientific results and so on.
You should be a politician, really.
Right.
You're very good.
And as told before, these facts could be used by others that have the mandate to use them. We don't have the mandate. I could speculate, and I frequently, you know, when I sit by myself or my friends or whatever, I speculate on these issues. But I don't have information that would stand in court. I don't have information that would stand in court if I was the one to be in court.
So any future court procedures will need much, much more work than the one you've done. It's not enough what you've done.
It will need our information and more, yes.
This is the last question. Thank you very much.
Asahi Shimbun. I just have a couple of questions regarding clarifications on the report. Could you provide the mission's simplified definition for sarin versus a sarin signature? And also, I'm under the impression that sarin is odorless, as with many chemical weapons, but in the report's witness accounts for certain cases, a foul-smelling odor is clearly mentioned. So the mandate doesn't require linking to who did it or how it was delivered, but could you clarify on the mission's link between the witness accounts of foul-smelling gases and the evidence as a trace of sarin? And what are the mission's official numbers for victims affected in each of the four confirmed incidents?
Oops. Look at the last point.
I take the last point, yeah.
sarin and sarin signatures. If you are early in an incident, like in the Ghouta incident, you may find intact sarin in the ground. You may find intact sarin in urine. You probably will never find intact sarin in the blood. You may if you have a very quick dose and come in after that. When we use the term sarin signature, that means that we have scientific evidence that sarin has been there and it left a mark. And the mark normally in the blood is that sarin is attaching to proteins in the blood. And the methodology is to in the laboratory then to flush sarin back into the sarin form and to measure the sarin form. So there's a measure that siren has been there, and we refer to that as a siren signature. Sometimes we refer to a siren signature that it's a breakdown product of siren that is there. So it encompasses that. You're correct. Siren is orderless, but whatever is also there at the same time, explosives, other chemicals, could smell. Amines, for instance, smell fishy. So there are other compounds around. And frequently, people are not very, very well, what shall I say, orientated in a situation like that. Their judgment is not very good. I mean, they are under pressure, enormous pressure. So their judgment is not very good. It could be other things that smells around, you know, other sort of explosives or tear gas or phosphorus or whatever. As to your last question about the victims' numbers.
That should teach you better to ask technical questions to professor. I will ask you to repeat the explanation. The number of victims are reported immediately by several sources. For instance, in Kara Lasal, the Minister of Health of the Syrian reported victims right the same day. And so did several forces for Ghouta. So it is really difficult to ascertain unless you go at the morgue and count the death certificate for it. And in some of the conditions we saw, is warlike conditions. So we can really get only what is written here is what we use to compare several sources in addition to the various reports, the first responders, sample taken. So it's really a jigsaw puzzle that we do.
Just as a follow-up, so the UN doesn't have any official numbers from their investigation on how many victims. It's too difficult to discern?
One of the doctors interviewing the first day was just saying, I was stuck in children's body, one on top of the other, to walk. So is really difficult to ascertain the number of victims. It's just that what happened was of certain magnitude, sometimes bigger, sometimes lower.
Okay, I'd like to thank all the members of the panel, and also thank you, journalists, for coming.